I'm personally very excited for this panel, so I hope you all are too. My name is Rania Salem, and I am with the U.S. Palestinian Community Network, the Chicago chapter. So I am just the MC today. So I will be introducing the loveliest panelists that we have this morning. So we have Tahr Hirzallah, who is the director of organizing at American Muslims for Palestine and a graduate student at the University of Minnesota, where he studies U.S.-born Muslim resistance to Zionism. And then we have, yes, claps. And then we have Janine Solanki, who is a Vancouver, Canadian-based anti-war and social justice organizer and the chair of Mobilization Against War and Occupation, also known as MAWU. And then, of course, we have Hussam Marajda, who is a community organizer and is actually the co-chair of the U.S.-Palestinian Community Network, the Chicago chapter. And, of course, as my comrade, I have to say he's one of the best, so... let's give a claps for our panelists here today.
Good morning. We're here to speak about Zionism and U.S. imperialism. So go ahead and start. So siblings, we know what Israel is. It is one large U.S. Army base. And before that, it was one large British Army base. The role of Israel is to maintain U.S. and Western hegemony over the Arab world and the Middle East. And it was placed there and established as an illegitimate state in 1948 for that reason specifically. It is there to ensure that any resistance and any dissent against U.S. imperialism and reactionary Arab regimes is neutralized. Israeli policy must not be viewed as separate from U.S. policy. It belongs 100% to the U.S. The weapons and resources are sold or granted by the United States, and it is informed about the majority of, if not all, military and political decisions. The U.S. supports this genocide that is happening right now unequivocally. The level of violation of international law, of brazen disregard for international diplomacy that we see from Israel and the United States right now is unprecedented. The United States has made it clear that it does not care about international law and that it will veto or not force Israel to abide by United Nations Security Council resolutions. That will not allow anything or anyone to threaten the existence of Israel, its watchdog in the Arab world. I don't think anyone in this room could have ever thought that a genocide that has already killed close to 35,000 Palestinians would be live streamed into our homes and that the United States would justify it. But that's what's happening. And the United States is showing the world how far it's willing to go and how much it's willing to do. And it is capable of doing more. And it is clear to all those who understand Netanyahu, the Israeli government and the Israeli society, that Israel's recent escalation against an Iranian diplomatic target in Syria and against Hezbollah and Iraqi targets is its way of trying to pull the United States even further into its quagmire. I do not believe it will happen, but Netanyahu only cares about his political survival at this point and will kill another 100,000 Palestinians and Arabs if he knew it would do the trick. In addition, the United States bully is also coming for those who are resisting, whether in Palestine or the United States or South Africa or all around the world. Our Palestinian-led mass movement is doing some incredible things in our streets, and law enforcement and Zionists are using all the tactics of repression in their arsenals, especially against students and community-based organizers and organizations. The brave people and government of South Africa stood up and brought a case against Israel to the International Court of Justice. And just 2 weeks ago, U.S. Palestinian Community Network, my organization, and the National Alliance Against Racism and Political Repression, one of the most important black liberation organizations in the entire United States, met with the brilliant South African Foreign Minister, Dr. Naledi Pandor. She told us there is a bipartisan bill in D.C. threatening sanctions, with one co-sponsor saying, "It is clear to me that the ANC of today is no longer the party of Nelson Mandela, and I am greatly concerned with South Africa's alignment with China and Russia and embracement of Hamas in the wake of the devastating October 7th attacks. And another bill saying, South African officials have made a miscalculation by aligning themselves with Russia and China. It is in our national security interest for the United States to review our relationships with nations that may not share our values and align themselves with such actors. Shame. So this is pretty clear that the United States is in the process of preparing sanctions against South Africa for their brave stance with the Palestinian people. This is a message to all the world. But while the United States and Israel dig in, we're also witnessing a rise in the level, will, and ability of the resistance access in the Arab world. I don't need to tell all of you, but regardless of what we hear from CNN and BBC and MSNBC and other corporate media every day, this isn't Israel versus Hamas. The Palestinian resistance represents all of the political movements, ideological trends, and social sectors of Palestinian society. Yes, Hamas has the strongest military of them all in Gaza, but the Marxist-Leninist forces and the other Muslim forces, the Social Democratic forces, the Nationalist forces, and even the Fatah-led forces are all fighting to defend the Palestinian people from ethnic cleansing and genocide, and are fighting under a unified military command. And if you want to know more about what they're doing, you could always read Al-Mayadeen English on the web, and then tune in to Electronic Intifada's podcast that has been providing not only great news, but great military analysis of the resistance in English. In addition, of course, we see that the incredible resistance in Yemen, Lebanon, Iraq, and Iran's refusal to, and Iraq and Iran's refusal to back down from the United States threats, all playing critical roles in making sure that the Palestinian resistance has the support it needs, ensuring that Israel's military cannot focus exclusively on Gaza, keeping the United States and other imperialist countries on their toes. Keeping the United States and other imperialist countries on their toes in the region and leveling the playing field a tiny bit. Even the narrative in this country is starting to shift. Although slowly, but because of the pressure that we in the United States Palestine support movement are putting on the complicit Democrats and the fear that they may lose voters and develop an even wider rift with their base. It is also because we have been shutting it down. Disrupting Genocide Joe and his cronies everywhere they gather, starting with a sit-in that my organization, United States Palestinian Community Network, organized in Chicago in Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky's office, less than 2 weeks after October 7th, which was one of the first arrests of those resisting the genocide, occurred. Schakowsky and Polkin and others just recently calling for a suspension of weapons sales, and Biden claiming on Thursday that he's demanding a ceasefire are a result of organizing pressure. But it's too little, too late. The United States and Biden are trying to save face and blame Netanyahu as a bad actor instead of Zionism and racism and settler colonialism and white supremacy and U.S. imperialism. But they won't recover. The Democratic Party won't recover, and United States imperialism won't recover. The Palestinian resistance and our fight for national liberation are hastening U.S. imperialism's decline, which we have been witnessing now for years. The United States is fighting a losing NATO war in Ukraine. It is spending a ton of money and political and diplomatic capital in Israel. It is losing its grip on Latin America, on Africa. China is becoming more dominant, not just in Asia, but expanding its influence with the Belt and Road Initiative in Africa and beyond as well. Internally, here in the United States, we are dealing with massive economic and political crisis as well. Important sectors in the Black liberation, Chicano liberation, Indigenous liberation, immigrant rights, and other national liberation and oppressed nationality movements are rising up against a system of injustice, racism, white supremacy, and capitalism that are inherent to the United States. These are all signs of a declining U.S. imperialism, and Palestine and Palestinians are at the forefront, inspiring the whole world with our sacrifices, our steadfastness, and our resistance. Of course, we mourn our martyrs every day and know how brutally difficult it is to read the news and study the stats and watch the videos. But I just want to remind everybody, Algeria lost more than 1 million beautiful souls in its battle for its independence. Vietnam lost more than 3 million beautiful souls to kick the French and U.S. imperialists out of their nation. And we in Palestine will do the same. Palestine is the anti-war and anti-intervention question of our time. A free Palestine and the return of all refugees and their descendants not only frees Palestinians from the shackles of Zionism, racism, and national oppression, but will also cut off a huge tentacle of U.S. imperialism in the world, aiding, abetting, and inspiring millions more to rise up and do just the same in the whole globe. And as USPCN constantly says and writes in all of our releases and statements, eventually the whole world acknowledged that South Africa had no right to exist as a racist, apartheid, white supremacist, settler colonial state. And eventually the whole world will come to the realization that Israel has no right to exist as a racist, apartheid, white supremacist, settler colonialist, Zionist state. So, this is the time to revive and reignite the anti-war movement. It has to become what it was during Vietnam in the 60s. And it has to continue to grow. Because we know what the U.S. wants. And they're going after China next. So this is the time to revive the anti-war movement in this country. It has to be the biggest in the history. And so make no mistakes. With our support in the United States and the support of hundreds of millions of other working and oppressed people across the world, Palestine is currently winning and will ultimately win with its full and total liberation on every inch of our land. And like we say in Arabic, من المية للمية. Palestine Arabia, from the water to the water, Palestine is Arab land. From the river to the sea, from the river to the sea, all power to the people. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. I am so inspired to be in this room with you all today, with my fellow panelists, and to connect and learn and talk about how we can build a united struggle against imperialist wars, occupations, sanctions, and our most critical fight today for ceasefire in Gaza and for the self-determination of Palestine. After all, here we are today in the belly of the beast where the decisive battles will occur. My name is Janine Solanke. I'm based in Vancouver, Canada, the chair of Mobilization Against War and Occupation, which has been organizing against imperialist wars and occupations for 20 years, always with a demand of freedom and self-determination for Palestine and all oppressed nations as an ongoing campaign of our organization. As I'm here representing Canada, or from an anti-war group in Canada, I want to take a moment to clarify a misleading headline regarding a recent motion in Canadian Parliament. You may have heard that Canada is stopping arms shipments to Israel, and unfortunately, this is not true. Unfortunately, Canada is continuing to ship arms to Israel, and I should note that Canada is a major arms manufacturer and dealer to the United States, to Saudi Arabia, to Israel, to many other countries, with over $28.5 million in military goods sent from Canada to Israel just between October and November last year, and $70 million of weapons exports approved between October 7th last year and January 8th, 2024. Among the other problematic language in the motion which reaffirmed Canada's support actually for Israel and condemnation of Hamas, regarding arms shipments specifically, the motion was to, and I quote, cease the further authorization and transfer of arms exports to Israel to ensure compliance with Canada's arms export regimen and to increase efforts to stop the illegal trade of arms, including to Hamas, end quote. This does not stop the export of arms that have already gotten export permits, which is potentially years worth of further arms exports, and does not also restrict so-called non-lethal exports, which includes component parts that go into deadly drones, fighter jets, and other weapons that Israel uses against our Palestinian sisters and brothers in Gaza. So as you see in Canada, we still have a big fight ahead of us against the government of Canada participating in the genocide against Palestinians alongside the struggle against U.S. imperialism, which is funding, arming, and giving political support to the Zionist apartheid regime of Israel. So that note aside, today we're engaged in the most critical struggle for liberation and self-determination of Palestine in the last 75 years. For 6 months, we've witnessed the unstoppable brutality of genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, against the Palestinian people in Gaza. And for 6 months, we, all of us in this room and beyond, have been part of a consistent and militant worldwide movement that has brought tens of millions of people onto the street, some who've been in solidarity with Palestine for decades, and some who've learned about Palestine in just the last few months but have been compelled to stand on the side of humanity and the side of Palestine. Mass consciousness in favor of humanity has been growing and growing. Observing the fascist acts of genocide of Palestinians by Israel has shocked people worldwide and has moved the hearts and the minds of hundreds of millions of people in the world in favor of humanity and Palestinian rights. Slogans and demands have rung through the streets and through our consciousness. Ceasefire now, end the genocide, shut it down. From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. U.S., stop arming and financing Israel. Reinstate UNRWA funding. Israel out of Gaza, end the siege. Free all Palestinian political prisoners. No justice, no peace. Biden and Netanyahu, we charge you with genocide. Palestine will be free. U.S., Canada, EU, you are complicit with genocide. Stop bombing Gaza and Rafah. And free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
All of these slogans, all in all of these words that have become a second nature for us to continue chanting day after day, this establishes that we are in the midst of an unfolding anti-war and pro-Palestine movement that has the potential to go beyond the Vietnam anti-war movement that many here, I know, were also part of. Palestinians are not fighting for their self-determination only. Their struggle for freedom and liberation has been radicalizing millions upon millions of people worldwide, thousands of miles away from Palestine and Gaza. The class struggle in Palestine and Israel has pushed hundreds of millions of working people and oppressed people to the center of politics. We are clearly witnessing that the worldwide mass movement to support the Palestinian struggle and Palestinian rights is moving to a higher stage of a powerful anti-imperialist movement. Hundreds of millions of people have not only questioned and scrutinized the fascist and genocidal acts of Israel, but also of the United States, of Canada, and Europe too. Due to this, I'd like to borrow a methodology from the Communist Manifesto and apply it to today. A specter is haunting the capitalist and imperialist world, the specter of an anti-imperialist movement. It's important that as we're at the stage of needing to reinforce and strengthen our movement to ensure that it keeps gaining momentum and has the leadership and vision to continue as a long-term struggle through a ceasefire and onto the self-determination of Palestine, that we understand the position Palestine holds in the struggle against imperialism in the entire region of West Asia and North Africa, and how we can strengthen our movement through unity and consistency. We're at the beginning of opening an epoch that must take the concept of united front seriously, and I mean very, very seriously. We must develop two concepts, unity in action for Palestine and building a robust anti-imperialist movement. Two objective and subjective reasons. One, despite the excellent and tireless efforts of anti-war organizations and various Palestinian groups, the mass movement of millions worldwide has remained merely mass spontaneous movement. This is where imperialists try to intervene and confuse the movement with their political maneuvering. Two, the scale of the mass movement worldwide is bigger than any organization, either anti-war, Palestinian, or the left in general, to sustain consistency in Palestinian solidarity movement building on the streets, in political direction, and in unified action in the US, Canada, and worldwide. We need coordination, a basic structure, and more consultation together. We can't win with only small-scale organization or move into building an anti-imperialist movement worldwide without building momentum and without connecting really to that powerful mass solidarity movement for Palestine that we're seeing worldwide. In the final analysis of politics and class struggle, to win has to be who has the highest numbers. And we have those numbers. We have humanity on the side, our side, on Palestine's side, and we need to keep organizing those numbers. For 75 years, we've seen Palestinians have tried every avenue to assert their right to self-determination, including legal and diplomatic measures. All so-called solutions imposed by imperialists and Israel on Palestinians since 1948, especially the Oslo Accords in 1993, have not brought peace and were never intended to bring peace or justice to Palestinians. Instead, as planned, they've prolonged and expanded the racist Zionist Israeli occupation and war against Palestine. From October 7, 2003, the defensive military operation of Palestinian resistance fighters from Gaza into Israel effectively ended all deceitful plans of the past, present, and future. The time of false promises and distractions is over. There is no going back to the status quo. The tide has turned, and the necessity of Palestinian self-determination and right to exist as a nation and to form a nation state and to dismantle the colonial state of Israel the way it is today is a struggle today that the world is fighting on the side of the Palestinian people. This struggle for Palestine reaches beyond the liberation of Palestine against Israeli occupation and extends into the fight against the new era of war and occupation, or as the US government claims it, the so-called war on terror, which has gripped West Asia and North Africa for over 23 years, since the invasion and occupation of Afghanistan in October to December of 2001. This is why imperialists in the White House, in Ottawa, in London, are risking so much to continue their support for Israel. The struggle for Palestine is also a fight against imperialism, whose warmongering has led by the U.S. with the support of their allies, including Canada, has been causing death and destruction in West Asia, North Africa, and beyond. And as we're spending this weekend discussing, and as we campaign about in our home cities, U.S. imperialism and its allies have killed 3 million people with their wars and occupations in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, Yemen, Sudan, and Somalia with their new era of war and occupation. Any words of restraint that the Biden administration says to Israel in their genocide is not out of concern for Palestinian lives. It's just that they're concerned that the killing is maybe being too direct, too outright, waking too many people up to the injustices committed by the U.S. government in their support for Israel, and risking their ability to continue launching military interventions and imperialist aggression around the world. Today, as we're calling for a ceasefire, as we're calling for an end to the brutal Zionist Israeli bombardment against the Palestinian people, we are not only directing that demand to the Israeli regime, but also to the United States government and all imperialists. This war is not just conducted by Israel. The U.S. government also bears a responsibility for their funding, arming, and political support of Israel from its creation in 1948 to the current genocide in Gaza. Right now, Biden, Trudeau, Sunak, all of these imperialist heads are maneuvering and desperately trying to justify their genocidal actions through the Israeli Zionist regime, pouring military aid and spinning media lies while the world increasingly sees the truth behind Israel's brutality. And this is not even because the imperialists really care about Israel, and most definitely not because they care about Jewish people, many of whom are on the streets in the movement for Palestine, but because their interest is to keep the colonial project secure, keep markets and resources throughout West Asia and North Africa within their hands. Uh-oh, I got the timesheet there. and to keep their populations, all of us, from rising up at home. So as we struggle for the freedom of Palestine, we're struggling for an end to imperialist hegemony and destruction in all of West Asia and North Africa. U.S. and all imperialists can't afford to lose another war after their big defeat in Ukraine and losing ground with the unfolding new Cold War. Despite the claims that Israel needed to be a safe homeland for Jewish people, we know that there's no safety when a state is imposed by genocidal occupation, and as has been done on Palestinian land. This was actually just a convenient solution for racism in Europe and North Africa, where historically and today Jewish people have faced anti-Semitism, and where Jewish people should have the right to live without discrimination. And in fact, what we should talk about and tell people about is that historically, today, and for Jewish people throughout history, they have been safest in West Asian countries, side by side with their Muslim neighbors. So, as we're told, sorry, I'm wrapping up, I promise. As we're told that the solution is complicated, it's in fact simple. Palestinians' legitimate demand for self-determination must be met. One person, one vote, where Palestinian people of any religion can live together in peace and harmony. It's only Zionist regimes and their imperialist backers that are blocking this only viable solution from becoming a reality. No liberation or freedom is possible for Palestinians as long as Zionism stands, which at its core is colonial and expansionist against Palestine. So I look forward to meeting and connecting with you all this weekend to combine our ideas, our creativity, our collaboration to strengthen the anti-war movement and the Palestine Solidarity Movement. One campaign that we've started in Vancouver is a new postcard campaign to Biden, which is demanding, which I have some examples of, and you can get at the table outside, which is demanding ceasefire now, Israel out of Gaza now, end the siege on Gaza now, reinstate UNRWA funding now, stop arming Israel, and stop funding Israel. So I encourage you to join us for this campaign. Please see your table, and you can sign up to get more information. Just to end, and I'm sorry for going over my time a minute or two, now more than ever, we need unity. We have to come together in a united front for Palestine to build this growing movement for ceasefire and for self-determination of Palestine. Together in this room and around the world, this movement has the potential and capacity to truly change the world for the better. Together for Palestine, for justice, for an end to wars, occupations, and imperialist aggression, we can and will win. And as they say in Cuba, venceremos.
Good morning, everyone. It is an absolute pleasure and honor to be among the most committed, most resilient, most radical organizers in this country, people who have been committed to this cause of anti-imperialism and anti-war for decades. And I'm also incredibly happy to see that there are so many new faces as well, people who have emerged as powerful players in the anti-war movement over the past 6 months as the global outrage continues in the circumstance or the context of this genocide. But I'm not here to be nostalgic. I'm not here to recollect on a bygone era where people were sitting in a cafe smoking cigars, speaking of armed resistance somewhere in Beirut. I'm here because I'm angry. I'm in a constant state of rage. As James Baldwin put it so eloquently, that to be conscious, to be aware, is to be in a constant state of rage. And for some of us, at least, the events of October 7th definitely shook the state of Israel. That's undoubted. They definitely removed the veneer of impenetrability that Israel had portrayed to the rest of the world. That within a span of several hours, young men, most of whom were orphans, unraveled a security regime that had taken 75 years to build. But it also shook us here. It also showed us how inadequately prepared we were to deal with this situation. And I'm here to help us provoke some questions, reflect on our work, that if for decades we've been engaged in anti-imperialist work, and if for decades we've been engaged in anti-war, we have been wholly inadequate in preventing genocide. And I don't say this as a way to demean the work that we've been doing or to lighten the incredible work that's been happening across the globe, but it's to shed a light on the fact that while we engage in this work and use these powerful slogans of anti-imperialism, have we truly engaged in what is necessary in order to retake power and to enact a whole new alternative to this global order that allows for genocide to take place unabated? And again, I apologize, I'm angry. I'm angry because I'm standing here in front of you at the Intercontinental on the river while my family in Gaza is starving to death slowly. I'm standing here in front of you today in a 5-star hotel while more than a dozen members of my family have been killed. our homes, everything we've built, everything that the Nakba generation built over the past 75 years has been destroyed, forcing us to now once again be displaced. So forgive me. Forgive me for my anger. The United States, on October 8th, had an opportunity to extend the life of its empire for possibly another 100 to 200 years. Had it not responded to the situation as it did. But because of its investment in this genocide, because of its active participation, because of its building of the conditions that created the situation in the first place, the United States has essentially, irreversibly, caused its own unraveling. And this is something that we will only come to understand in the years and decades to come. That this was the moment, more than any other moment, where the tides have shifted. Because not only are people questioning the US's role or Canada's role or the UK's role, people are now questioning the entire neoliberal global order. People are questioning international law. People are questioning the ICC and the ICJ. People are questioning World Bank and IMF in ways that we haven't seen before. But on top of that, we have the normalization of something that's taking place that I could not have imagined on October 6th. And that is the normalization and the coming to understanding of resistance. Because let's be honest with ourselves. Islamic resistance in particular is so unintelligible to a Western audience that even among allies, on the days immediately after October 7th, some people were questioning whether or not this was necessary. Some people were questioning the allegations that were being leveled and made by the State of Israel and using them as justification to issue condemnations left and right. And what I want to hopefully bring today is a question of where do we stand really? Where are we going to put our foot down? Are we going to allow the discourse-shaping narrative of a global media machine, of a Zionist entity, of an American empire, to dictate the terms by which we resist our occupiers? And this is something for me that's critically important. Because that narrative shift that's taking place, it's not just about whether or not Palestine should be free. That's a foregone conclusion. If you look at all the polls, especially among the younger generations, Gen Z and millennials, it's not about whether or not they know enough to make a determination that they, you know, they could choose between Palestinians and Israelis. Who do you favor more? You know, these old, you know, these old polls that we used to see on Gallup. You know, who do you favor, Israelis or Palestinians? As if it's like sort of, you know, chocolate ice cream or vanilla. Now the discussion is among Gen Z and millennials in particular, is do you support Hamas? That is something I could have never imagined happening before. Especially in the context of the counterterrorism discourse that we have all been subjected to over the past two decades. And this is a shift that is uncontrollable, that the United States cannot control. And this is a global shift. These are global trends, not just trends here in the United States. So when we look at this situation, And we come to understand the genocide for what it is. And as so eloquently described by the two previous panelists, I think to myself, what is our role? Yes, unity is great. Yes, mass mobilizations have been fundamentally history-altering, where millions of people are taking to the streets every single day for the past 6 months. That's profoundly important in this moment. And it means a lot to the people of Gaza, I'll tell you that. But when do we realize that we have to go beyond? That maybe our tactics that we've been using are not adequate enough. That maybe the moves that we're making need to be reassessed. That the political process that we've been sort of conditioned to believe is the only way that we could make a change or voice our opinions is not sufficient for what we want to achieve. Because we want to achieve a world where this is no longer possible. We want to achieve a world where the military machine cannot exist the way it does today. And when we ask ourselves these questions, then we come to the realization that, you know, what we're doing is wholly inadequate. And so what do I propose then as an alternative? And I don't have all the answers. I don't. But what I hope to do is at least start the conversation. And I know that you all have been having these conversations. I know that this is something that's been at the top of the minds of so many of our great thinkers and so many of our panelists here over the past, not just this conference, but over the past several decades. But the global power is shifting. And as global power shifts, conflict increases. And we see what's happening in the world. We know that a war with China is imminent. We know that a war with Russia is imminent. But we also know now that the global South will not be left to the wayside for global powers to decide what's next for them. What the Yemenis are doing today, what the Lebanese are doing today, what the Iraqis are doing today, what the Palestinians have been doing for decades, showing the world that at the end of the day, no matter how many good political analysts you have, or how many incredible historians you have, or how many think tanks you have working on policy issues, at the end of the day, what matters is what happens on the ground. Because nobody in their right mind, no military analyst or strategist could have ever told you that after 180 days, Palestinian resistance is still whooping Israel's butt. CIA will say, we knew this all along. You know, we tried to tell them. Nobody wanted to believe it. That's what it was. They always wanted to believe that the subaltern, the oppressed, the wretched of the earth were content with being under the boot of the white supremacist forces. That no matter what they did, they could never have enough power to challenge the status quo and the forces that be. But Gaza showed us. Gaza showed us that the most surveilled, oppressed, besieged, starved people on this earth can mount a campaign for liberation unlike anything we have ever seen in the history of the Palestinian liberation struggle. But they've been preparing for that. They've been working on that for a long time. 10 years at least, if not more. Question I have for all of us is, what have we been preparing for? where and when is that rupture for us going to be taking place? And how do we get ready for that? And so I leave you with hopefully a positive message that I think it's possible, that we can learn and be inspired by and take initiative from the heroic people of Gaza and their steadfastness and their samud in the face of the ugliest brutality that I have seen in my lifetime. And I hope that we can work together and make that happen. Thank you so much.
Hello, thank you all for being here. Wonderful speeches. My question is, in terms of taking the next step and changing the tides, how do we talk to Americans about resistance? How do we turn Americans into pro-resistance people?
Well, first of all, I think one of the most important things for me, at least, is to not use the language of extremism or radicalism to characterize resistance. I think it's very normal to think about resistance as a natural result of circumstances. And so when we use that terminology sometimes, and I think that's it's very troubling to see that even among allies, this language of extremism and radicalism is used. But there's nothing radical about wanting to free yourself from occupation. It's a very normal thing. And it's not like Hamas or any other resistance movement in Palestine is using tactics that haven't been used before. This is all stuff it's a story that's been written for decades and decades before. So, you know, normalizing the way we discuss these things as something that, like the normative way for understanding history and looking at this occupation as what it is, as the abnormal thing, as the aberration itself, not Palestinian resistance as an aberration or something abnormal, but looking at the occupation and colonization as the aberration, right? As something that should not exist, something that should not be there in the first place. I think that's one of the most important things for me, at least, in sort of creating that discourse shift. And then the other thing I would say to that is, we shouldn't fall prey to the fear that discussing these things might alienate or disenchant people we're talking to about the issue of Palestine. Because we've seen more people in the past 6 months come to the right conclusions because of the fact that an act of resistance such as what happened on October 7th took place. Whereas for the decades that I've been working on Palestine work, as many pamphlets as I've handed out and as many lectures I've given on the Nakba and the history of Palestine, I've never been able to mobilize this many people. So resistance creates solidarity, naturally. And so in order for us to move the needle, what do we need more of? Resistance. And so I hope that that's what we get to. And I think that answers your question. Thank you.
I think Taha had covered all of it, but I just want to add a small note, is that we definitely need to work on building the left. A left that is going to support the global south without conditions. I don't want an anti-war movement. I don't want an anti-war movement in the left that's going to put conditions on Venezuela, Cuba, Palestine, right? We need to start here, and then when we expand our reach, our movement, when we grow, we need to learn that when we stand with oppressed people, we stand with them unconditionally. We want them to be free of imperialism. And once those people, that people, the nation is free of imperialism, they have the self-determination to figure out their internal contradictions and their problems. And so we can't be supporting of any people, but not supporting their resistance. They have the right to resist by any means necessary that fits the time and the settings and the conditions that they have on the ground. And that goes not just for Palestine, like I just said, for Venezuela, for Cuba, for all oppressed people across the world. And so just to keep that in mind as well, because there was a lot of like, yeah, we support Palestine, but we need to get rid of that.
I don't have much more to say because my two brothers here answered that question, I think, perfectly. But I will say that I think our responsibility and what we've seen over the last 6 months is that as education increases, as people learn more about the history of the Palestinian struggle, about the atrocities that today and throughout the last 75 years Palestinians have faced and endured, the natural progression is for people to start getting familiar with the idea of being in support and defending Palestinians' right to resistance. So I think continuing that education and our discussions is so important. But also, as our friend here said, how do we turn Americans into pro-resistance people? We might have 20 different or more ideas of what pro-resistance means in this room. The fact is we need to continue being pro-Palestine and building a pro-Palestine movement. And the finer details of what pro-resistance means, what exactly, you know, the finer details that people support in the struggle for Palestine, I think will come to be more unified, more together, as the struggle together continues.
Please, the next question.
I want to salute the panelists for your very insightful commentary. But I wanted to raise a couple of questions. One of the challenges we have in terms of transforming resistance in the U.S. is to impart to people that the realities in the U.S. is such where we are part of a resistance process. That one of the insights that people have now come to glean from Gaza is not only the true nature of the Israeli settler colonial project, but people are starting to make the connection between Israel and Palestine and this settler colonial project called the United States of America. So that understanding of a common struggle is part of the tools that we need to utilize in terms of building resistance here in this country. I also wanted to raise a question regarding where we are in terms of this transformation of consciousness that's taking place as a consequence of the of what happened beginning October the 7th. Colleague commented that when we look at the resistance, that some of it doesn't seem to be adequate enough. I want to hear some more about that because it seems to me that, as you said yourself, what we've seen over the last 6 months has been unprecedented in terms of the millions of people who have come out in support of the anti-colonial struggles in Palestine. Now, what hasn't happened yet, though, is that process playing out to its logical conclusion. The logical conclusion is to go from calls for a ceasefire to calls for Palestinian liberation. Now, that process is, in fact, happening. So I want to make sure that... okay, I'm getting the sheet already. I want to make sure that we aren't premature in suggesting that what is unfolding is not good enough yet. I don't think you're saying that completely. But we have to let this process play out. because we, I think, recognize in this room there's no turning back. You know, for many of us who have been involved in Palestinian support work for decades, as you were saying, it wasn't very many times we would have 15, 20 people in a room talking about Zionism. You know, even among activists, there was a point where maybe 2 out of 10 could give you a working definition of Zionism. But that's not the case today. Today I got my sisters who, you know, represent, I think, the average person in this country, and they're now talking about anti-Zionism. So we have turned the corner, and that process has to continue.
Hi, I know in Chicago, y'all passed a ceasefire resolution, and to do that, you made, as well as other cities that have passed ceasefire resolutions, different organizations had to work together, and some had to make compromises, and some had to discourage people from provoking or antagonizing city council members at times. I know that in other cases in New Orleans, we've often had the discussion of some, especially for solidarity groups, you might have some Palestinian groups, not all, but some Palestinian groups discouraging speaking on the Intifada or vocalizing support for the resistance. I would like to know how you decide how to make those kinds of compromises and work together and when to make concessions and when not to.
In these situations, I would say, you know, every city is different and every city council is different. In Chicago, the movement have, you know, there's several council members who came out of the movement. We have a mayor that is a trade unionist, came out of the teachers union, right? So pretty progressive guy. And so it was easier for us to put like a stronger resolution than other cities. And we did have to make compromises. The right wing, the Zionists, and even like, you know, alderwoman who were part of the Black Caucus, who voted yes on it, but they did come to us and say, well, we need you to remove the sentence, and you're removing the sentence and other things. And you just have to kind of like assess the situation and also recognize that like American cities are super Zionist. and you do have to, you know, you're not gonna put a resolution there that's gonna say, you know, globalize the Intifada and support the resistance. You're never gonna be able to do that, not now, at least, right? And so you have to read, you know, you have to be able to assess the relationships you have with the city council members, how far you're willing to go. I always, of course, would push the needle, but you also wanna, like, the goal is to pass a resolution, and if you think something is gonna compromise that, then try to like water it down a little bit, just a little bit. You know what I mean? Oh, well, yeah, I mean, this is the self-determination that, you know, we talk about, right? Palestinian organizations are in the leadership of this movement, right? It's also, this is what self-determination means, and all organizations must respect that and follow the leadership of the Palestinian organizations. And the Palestinian organizations themselves have to figure out, you know, how they want this resolution to be written, and all other organizations have to follow suit.
So I think first, I agree with my brother in the middle here that uniting struggles and fighting against our common enemy and realizing those connections we have is what brings us from a pro-Palestine movement to a broader anti-imperialist movement. And we also know the dangers that we face. We know throughout history and throughout our movements, divide and conquer is the playbook of all imperialists and all colonial powers. And we have to be very careful not to fall prey to that and to focus on having a united front. And that does go to the next question there, because how do we have a united front? How do we put aside differences that we may have on some of the finer details, and even some of the bigger ones? How do we have discussions and debates to see how we can work together, because we need to work together? I think in the case of going to more civil society institutions like city municipal governments in Canada. That's been happening at city halls. Is really focusing on the demand of ceasefire. Ceasefire is the single demand that unites people the most around the world, across political stripes, across our many differences, that we need to focus on. Of course, that's not the only demand. We can push for self-determination. We can push for many different demands in support of Palestine. But I think we need to start and unite on ceasefire. And also, I think in the many decisions on how to conduct ourselves, what kind of actions to take, what kind of demands to have on the streets and in our actions, we always have to be asking ourselves, will this action I'm considering or this decision or this demand, does this make our movement stronger? Does this make our struggle more understandable to people that we want to bring onto our side? And if it doesn't, maybe it's not the right action. If it's something that maybe gets us more social media views, but maybe is not something that helps people understand the Palestinian struggle, we need to question that. So always, I think, thinking, does this serve our movement? Does this bring more people onto our side? And does this put our movement for Palestine in a better position? Needs to be the question for every action that we do.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to address the point that our brother John Wabarakah posed, and that is, I suppose my comment was not about the lack thereof, but more about prior to October 7th, where were we, right? Because since October 7th, a lot of incredible things have happened. And like you said, the conversation and the needle is moving in ways that we couldn't have imagined. And I think that's a very positive development. And I think people are going to reach those natural conclusions as a result of these actions. But what bothered me was, prior to that, where were we insofar as how we organized ourselves and how we set things up in order to have power, in order to have influence in different areas to prevent or make it a lot harder for the U.S. government and for the military-industrial complex to just do whatever it wanted, right? And I think that's something that was what I wanted to say was wholly inadequate. The question about the ceasefire resolutions, and I just want to address this quickly. I know that some people see them as merely symbolic, and maybe in the grand scheme of things, not as important. But just to reiterate some of the points that my co-panelists brought out, and to add on to that, I think they're very strategic, actually, politically speaking. And the reason why I say that is because, number one, you're now conditioning local elected officials that their political future is tied to their position on Palestine. Whereas before, that wasn't something that was really clearly articulated, right? Number two is, local lobbying is a lot easier and more effective than national lobbying is. You could have a million emails sent to Joe Biden right now, and he still wouldn't call for a ceasefire, right? But you could have 30 emails going to some small-town city council member, and next thing you know, they're going to be calling for Free Palestine, right? So there's a big difference there in the power dynamic, and I think that's something, for me at least, that I found very positive about the ceasefire. And that's why we have, I think, 4 or 5 that passed in the state of Minnesota already. 5. And the language of some of these resolutions is very, very strong. I mean, it's not watered down like in Chicago. I mean, no disrespect to Chicago, but like, you know, we had some really, really strong language, and it wasn't like the two sides condemnation language. It was very straightforward. This is genocide. This needs to end. Boom. And we call on the U.S. government to end all aid to Israel. Like, that was great. So I think these are very positive developments in that regard, and I hope that we continue on that path, even as the demands change. And as I think what you're saying is very on point. Ceasefire is sort of the universal demand that everyone agrees upon. But what's next?
if Gaza gets a ceasefire tomorrow, does Gaza's suffering end? No, absolutely not. Because Gaza is completely destroyed. And Palestinians would still be under occupation and under siege. So the ceasefire is obviously minimal. We all know that. But we can move on to the next step. Okay, and I think that's a very positive thing. So thank you for that question.
Okay, I guess following the theme of concessions that you have to give to city council, I know Meredith talked about the St. Paul City Council. It was quite watered down. And Antar mentioned our anti-resistance nature. So how do we move past that sense of American immediate gratification and go towards the lack of the propagandized nature that we already have been born with here to move towards that pro-resistance nature?
If I understand your question correctly, sort of how do we reach a critical mass, so to speak, that will hopefully usher in a new political reality? And I think that's a very good question, and I think that's something that all of us have been working on for a long time. You know, like, all of us want to have bigger, better, stronger unions. All of us want to have more people educated on Palestine. All of us want to have more people involved in climate change and whatnot. And so that's something that we're always constantly trying to bring new people into. But there's something that I kind of want to... And I'm sorry I'm taking a lot of space on this panel, but I just wanted to caution that we shouldn't wait for that critical mass to arise before we engage in the political work that we want to do, in the political transformation that we want. Because let me give you an example. The vast majority of Americans today support gun control legislation, right? Vast majority. It's undoubted. All the data speaks to it. All the polling speaks to it. Yet, the U.S. government has not moved on this issue. And there's like millions of phone calls being made, emails being sent, protests being done, parents of mass shooting victims literally like almost punching congressmen. And still, no gun control legislation has passed. Even under the guy who said he was going to do it, right? So for me, that is an example of or an indication that critical mass does not translate to new political reality. And so I understand the visceral need to educate everyone about the history of Palestine in order for them to get to the point that we're at, right? But that doesn't mean that we will ultimately get to the political point that we want to. It's radical action and resistance that gets us to that point. When people see you on the street, when provocation takes place, that's what gets people's minds to work. Because I can organize as many panels as I want, as many conferences as I want. And we can have like hundreds of people. At the end of the day, that amount of people is not going to alter the political reality, right? And so what I was trying to say, I guess, related to the first point that I was trying to make that our brother Ajam Mubaraka sort of commented on, is that how can we think about the work that we do transformatively as a radical political project that will provoke that response that's been provoked since October 7th in a broader way, right? And I hope I answered your question based on what you were intending it to be asked.
Just feel like I have to put this on record, but Chicago's ceasefire resolution was not watered down. I was saying if you have to water it down, depending on the conditions you're in with your city, you can, but ours was actually pretty strong. But I think that, so raise your hand if you're actually a part of an organization. Okay, that's everybody here, almost. So that's good. Organizing. We have to build our organizations. Organizations are, you know, what's going to win. And we have to make those connections. We have to build the Black Liberation Movement. We have to build the Immigrant Rights Movement. We have to build the Climate Change Movement, right? We have to build the Anti-War Movement, the Palestine. We got to build it. We got to organize. We have to have militant organization. Our enemies are all organized. They have a lot of money, and they're organized. And so we have to grow, and we have to continue to be organizing, and we have to, you know, show our power. Our power is in the numbers. And so we have to put divisions aside, sectarianism aside, and organize and continue to grow. And every person you can make a connection to. You can make a Palestinian connection to that person, right? And you could organize them based on what they can relate to. But it is super, super important that we're not just reactive. We're not just out in the streets. We're not just, you know, doing direct actions when there's a genocide happening. You know what I mean? We gotta be proactive. And after the ceasefire, like you said, brother, end of Zionism. That's it. That's our goal. Free Palestine, end of Zionism, and that's going to be our goal. That's what we organize, and that's how we're going to be proactive towards.
Free, free Palestine! Free, free Palestine! Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
That was beautiful. I couldn't agree more with the last comments of my two fellow panelists. As I said before, I think up till now we've seen the spontaneous movement of people that have, through their consciousness in response to the atrocities they've seen on their screens, have come to the streets. But now is where the real work begins for us. We need to keep people coming out to the streets. We need to turn that spontaneity into politicization to help people understand that this is a long-term struggle past ceasefire, to show also to people that there is a leadership, that there is a leadership that is working on building the movement and a leadership they can trust. So I think the big question is, how do we keep that momentum growing? And that is through consistent organizing, clarity of demands and political issues, and bringing people consistently onto the streets, that builds the confidence of people. When they look around and they see thousands and they say millions, that elevates that mass consciousness to fight to win. And the key to winning is increasing the mass movement and united movement. I think we can learn positively from the Vietnam anti-war movement, which was successful on focusing on the demand of out now, which millions of people chanted daily on the streets and in campuses. But I think we can also learn from the negative experience of the mass movement before the war on Iraq in 2003, where millions of people came out, but without the ongoing consistency and momentum. And I think faced a demoralization when a few mass and huge, incredible protests didn't bring an end to that war and occupation. We need to have the clarity of direction and leadership that a mass movement is not an overnight thing, that this is a long-term struggle, and that that mass movement needs to build and grow and build momentum. So thank you, everyone.
All right, everyone. As we end this panel, I would just like to say, when I say people, you say power. People. People!
Power.
People!
Power.
A round of applause for our panelists here today. Thank you, everyone.
That was a wonderful panel. That was what we needed to hear. We're going to hear from someone who has learned to take power in the name of the people. And there's a lot more to come in the conference. There's a lot of workshops, which we all can speak in, and a lot more panels. And we're going to try to keep the conference moving on time, so we do have timekeepers. But I also want to mention that in your brochure, if your organization, and I saw everybody put up their hand when they said they're a member of organization, if your organization is not yet a member of UNAC, there's a form in here you could join. Because it is through militant anti-imperialist unity that we're going to do the kinds of things that we heard that we need to do today. So I'd urge you to do that. So I'm going to introduce someone who's going to introduce our next speaker. I'm going to introduce Mairead Gillis, who is a solidarity activist and recently returned from Nicaragua. And she's going to introduce our next speaker.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Mairead, and I am a member of Workers' World Party in Boston. As we move deeper into our conference on decolonization and the fight against imperialism, it is crucial that our allies from Latin America take part in the conversation. Nicaragua has a profound century-plus long history of successfully pushing back Western imperialism and U.S. interventions. From military invasion to bloody U.S.-backed dictatorship to coup attempts and criminal sanctions to this day, the people of Nicaragua have heroically stood strong in resisting these attacks on their sovereignty and defending their right by any and all means and the right of those around the world, including in Palestine, to determine their own just path without the boot of imperialism on their necks. This July, Nicaragua will be celebrating 45 years since the victory of the Sandinista Revolution, which continuously exemplifies its people-centered revolutionary process through access to free, quality education and healthcare, prioritizing nutrition, clean energy and water, social programs for vulnerable communities, dignity for elders, gender equality, respect for workers and organized labor, protection of the environment, improved quality infrastructure across the country, and constant new victories for the people. Siempre más allá. We call for self-determination for Latin America and all nations of the global South. U.S. hands off Nicaragua. So, it is my sincere honor to welcome to the podium Nicaraguan Ambassador Lautaro Sandino, head of mission at the Nicaraguan Embassy in Washington, D.C. We are so glad that you are here. Viva la Revolución Sandinista and long live the solidarity between our peoples as we unite in our shared struggle against imperialist hegemony and the war against our class. So please give Ambassador Sandino a warm, warm welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. I hope that my English is well enough. I prepared a speech and I found out that the translation that I did, it was absolutely wrong. That is the problem when you put your word in Spanish and then you try to transmit to another language. But anyway, I will do my best. I want to tell you a little story. When I was 22 years old, it's 41 years ago, I came to the United States for the first time of my life. There was a tour that was organized by many organizations here. And I visited 51 cities of the United States in 2 months. So I have a dear feeling about the people of the United States. And when I was coming here, I was thinking in Tomás Borges, commander of the revolution that said, that solidarity is the tenderness of people. And I am able to feel that here. Thank you so much for your support. I want to give you, on behalf of President Ortega and Vice President Rosario Murillo, the worm is salutation, salute, hi, wish you well. But this is no rhetorical thing to say for a diplomat like me. When we say on behalf of our president and our vice president, it is a reality. She knows, or they know, that I am here, and they know that I am speaking to you, explaining the good things that we have been doing in Nicaragua in order to give a restitution of rights. In Nicaragua, we don't want to say that we have achievements. We are not saying that the government is giving the people things. We are restitution, the rights of the people to have a better life. That's the point. That's the whole point. That's the whole idea that we have. So it is not because the government is nice. It's our good government, as we like to say. But our government is restituting the rights of the Nicaraguan people. And so far, we have been doing well. We have universal, a free health care throughout the country. We built about 24 new hospitals. We have created a house for maternity in order to lower the mother death. We have universal education. From preschool to university, we are creating labor center of education, technical centers, and so on. The economy of Nicaragua has been doing well, very well. And we have been consistently having a growth of about 4-5% every year. Even the attempt of coup d'etat we have in 2008 and the COVID pandemic. And we are recuperating. We are recuperating. We are doing it so well. Did you know that Nicaragua is ranked in the 7th place of gender equality? 7th place. By law, 50% of all the public elected representatives must be women. That's very nice. And you know about this? It is interesting to when people say or tell us, why you said president and vice president? It's a couple. It's a gender. In our idea and in the new thinking, we have to work together, men and women. So the decision has to be taken by men and women in equality, not in a different way. And when women take the lead, it is better. That is a fact. What can I say? Another story. When my mother takes decisions, they are very good ones. When my father did, it was terrible. So, also, we have been developing renewable energy very well. We have been working with that. We even have the guts to denounce at the beginning the Paris Agreement, because it was not good enough. We did it. Okay? Now about 40, we have 90.4% of electricity coverage in the country. That is remarkable. And we have been working with renewable energy. Our government has been giving house for people. We have improving the roads and so on. And we can talk about many things that my government is doing in favor of the Nicaraguan people. And all this explain why our government, according to the polls, had about 83% of support in the policies. Even though in the international media, they said that we are doing wrong. But you know about the corporate media, I believe that you call it. But anyway, see, the thing is that in Nicaragua, we have been building a new society, and you are helping us of doing it in one way that it is important for our people. There is an organization in Latin America, in the Americas, as you might know. We don't recognize them. We denounce them. We don't want nobody to tell us what to do. And we will continue like that. I want to express our solidarity with the people that are fighting for the independence, sovereignty, national dignity. Our solidarity is with Venezuela, with Cuba, with the people of Puerto Rico, with our brother from the Polisario Front, and of course with the patriot and revolutionaries of Africa that are fighting against colonialism. That is part of our idea. In December last year, there was a high-level policy consultative conference about the situation in Palestine. And I want to read you what my government said about it, okay, in that conference. It said, we clearly say and will continue to express our fraternal and militant solidarity with the Palestinian people and their cause. Humanity continues to be outraged and stunned by the inhumane aggression, genocide, and serious war crimes committed by the Zionist state against the people of Palestine and Gaza and the West Bank. But my government goes even further. We said that the government of Israel is turning itself into a state incompatible with the community of states that makes up the United Nations. Their supremacy criminally is unparalleled in human story. It's what we say. It's what we live. As you know, South Africa sued Palestine before the International Court of Justice. Nicaragua went. We were one of the first to go to explain our position supporting the sue of South Africa. We believe that is brave. In our experience, we sued the United States in 1984. And we won. That was the best part. They never pay. Anyway. But now we have sued Germany. And I believe that we are thinking in the Netherlands, Canada. That might be the next. Okay. And some people said, hey, why are you suing Germany and not the Israel? You know, in our thinking, nor United States or Israel will follow the decision of the International Court of Justice. They don't recognize it. There is no jurisdiction. But guess what? Germany does. So we are saying, look, you are not fulfilling your duty to preserve somebody to kill and to commit a genocide. That's why we are suing Germany. That is our position. Okay? So, what we do now, keep going, resist, mobilize. That is the whole idea, I believe. Mobilize, keep doing it. Don't get tired. And when you get tired, do it again. It's a way. You know, another story. When you get old, you like to tell story. There is a book of a commander of the Sandinista Revolution that is called Omar Cabezas. He was a guerrilla fighter, okay? So he was very young, he went to the mountains, and he said that another hero of the revolution said that the new man was in the plus effort. And he said that in his book. So all of us read it all the time. So I was mobilized. And I went to the mountains. And it was very hard. It was very hard. And I remember Omar Cabezas' book. So if I wanted to be the new man or women, I had to put a plus effort in order to achieve what I want. If we want to be a new man, and if we want to have a new Palestine and a free Palestine, we had to keep going. Never stop. But anyway, I think that this is the thing that I wanted to share with you. But before I conclude, I want to read a quote from Che Guevara that we should remember always. Above all, always be able to feel in the depth of any injustice committed against anyone in any part of the world, that is the most beautiful quality of a revolutionary. Keep that in mind. Courage. The truth is ours, and the victory is certain. Patria libre o morir. Thank you very much.